from Podcast One.
Coming up in this episode of Target USA, we go back to the man who started it all on Target USA.
ISIS has a very, very malign intent towards the West and towards the United States. But they don't have the capability, fortunately, at least at this point, in terms of destructive power that Russia has.
That was James Clapper, Director of National Intelligence at the time, on March 3rd, 2016. And his comments came 8 months before the U.S. knew what Russia was trying to do with the U.S. election. He sounded the alarm well before Russia's election interference plot was exposed.
Russia, in contrast, has huge capabilities, which if they chose to unleash, could render huge harm to this country.
And in a brand new interview about his new book, Facts and Fears, James Clapper talks about that Russia problem, and he talks about his current concerns and worries moving forward about the country when it comes to Russian interference.
But the hardest part of all this, JJ, is getting the public to understand what the Russians are doing, understand how massive the effort is that they've made, and that they will continue to do that, and they absolutely positively must be more questioning, more inquisitive about things that they read or hear.
That's coming up on this edition of Target USA,
the National Security Podcast.
From WTOP in Washington, D.C., this is Target USA. Russia
could render huge harm to this country.
North Korea's secret missile,
capable of reaching the whole of the United States.
Dangerous terrorist.
D.C. is repeatedly mentioned as someplace they would like to seek an attack.
Cyber criminals.
Decryption successful.
America has a target on its back. And on this program, we investigate the threats, the people behind them, the agencies fighting them, and the impact on you. This is Target USA,
the National Security Podcast.
I'm J.J. Green. James Clapper spent more than 50 years in the U.S. intelligence community. His last posting was Director of National Intelligence under President Barack Obama. He's written a book about his career. It's called Facts and Fears. He led the U.S. intelligence community through a period that included the raid on Osama bin Laden, the Benghazi attacks, the leaks of Edward Snowden, and Russia's influence operation during the 2016 U.S. election campaign. In the book, Facts and Fears, Clapper discusses the growing threat of cyber attacks, his relationships with presidents and Congress, and the truth about Russia's role in the presidential election, something we focus heavily on in this podcast. And this is how it began. Why did you write this book?
Well, that's a great question. And originally, I wasn't going to write a book. It seemed to me a mountain too high. But things changed for me when I understood the magnitude of what the Russians did. And, of course, I say understood. This was the understanding I had before I left the government. And, of course, it's increased since then. But I've seen a lot of bad stuff in my 50-plus years in intelligence, but nothing that disturbed me as much as this did, because of the attacks on our fundamental pillars of our political system. And I thought I needed to do my little part in trying to educate the public about the threat the Russians pose.
When you look back at what you've learned since you left government, because it was fairly clear early on that you knew the Russians could do some bad things to the U.S. And in fact, I'll tell you this. Our last interview was in late 2015, and you said, I'll quote you here, Russia could render huge harm to this country, end quote. Did you have any idea at that time of what we discovered later, before the 2016 election and shortly afterwards, of course, after the election in 2017 when you did your assessment and did the public unveiling of that assessment. Did you have any idea when you made that statement that Russia could do render huge harm to this country? Any idea of just the magnitude?
JJ, you've done your homework, and the answer to your question is no, because what I had in mind when I made that statement was the other dimension of the threat posed by Russia, which we don't talk about much these days, which has actually gotten more disturbing since 2015, and that is their concerted effort to modernize their strategic arsenal. And you may recall Putin's speech of the 1st of March, which was accompanied by graphics to illustrate about five weapons, one of which is called the Weapon of Vengeance. And all those weapon systems are designed with one adversary in mind, the United States. So that's actually what I had in mind in 2015. And I did not foresee the magnitude of what the Russians did during the run-up to our election.
Now that you know and have seen, connected the dots to what you suspected very clearly, way before anybody else seem to have this idea, a lot of people seem to have moved on beyond Russia. And I've spoken to some people who've said, perhaps former intelligence officials who've said perhaps they had made mistakes, their own mistakes, by not spending as much time focusing on Russia in the years leading up to what we discovered in 2016 and shortly thereafter. But I'm just wondering, based on what you know now, and what you've seen as a result of these weapons, some of them called the doomsday nuclear type weapons, do you get the sense that they're of a mind to try to use these weapons?
No, I don't think so. I think, as always, this is not unlike the Cold War era, and it has to do with a lot with psychology. And the need for Russia to feel that they are, in fact, a great power. And, in fact, this is a motivation of Putin himself. He has this grand vision of a greater Russia. And I've always characterized him as actually a throwback to the czars, not so much a throwback to the Soviet era. So I don't think they're going to use them, but I worry about the proliferation of these weapons and whether or not we're going to keep pace. And particularly with respect to missile defense, it appears we are, but that's going to remain a concern.
One of the things that comes out in your book is, and I'm quoting here from some of the highlights, the reluctance of the Obama administration to be more assertive, not wanting to amplify the Russians or appear to tip the scale in favor of Secretary Clinton in the presidential race. I'd like it if you could give us a sense of how difficult that balance was for you.
Well, yeah, it was because there's a long history of Russians interfering in elections, theirs and other people's, and ours, going back to the '60s. So, we anticipated unfortunately, an ambient level of interference and fishing around on our elections. But over the summer of 16 and into the early fall, we began to gather more information, have greater insight into what they were doing. And that prompted many long and intense discussions about what to do about it. And as you indicated, the quote from the book is, to try to capture that. What were the inhibitors that restricted or inhibited a more robust response? Well, one was concern about amping up or magnifying what the Russians were doing, and the perception, the optic, and President Obama, I think, is very concerned about this, and understandably so, putting his hand on the scale, as you said, in favor of one candidate and disfavor of the other. All of this against the backdrop, by the way, of Mr. Trump beginning to prepare the battlefield for his losing the election by alleging that it was going to be rigged. And so the president was very reluctant to play to that narrative. And the other part of this was the reluctance of the Republicans in the Congress to join in a strong bipartisan statement about what the Russians were doing. So all these factors played in a highly charged, controversial election campaign anyway that served to inhibit perhaps what some might consider an earlier and more robust response by the Obama administration.
So the election happened, and Mr. Trump won the election, And not long after that, there was quite a bit of consternation regarding the assessment that you made in January, the public release of that in 17, and questions about the integrity of the intelligence community. We actually, maybe we did speak again between 2015 and now. I think maybe we spoke for a moment or two.
About, I think we did.
Yes, about that, your concerns about the president's beating up on the intelligence community. How much damage did that do?
Well, that's hard to say. It's hard to gauge. I think right now the intelligence community is kind of not in the crosshairs as much as Department of Justice or the FBI. But I'll speak for them, specifically the FBI, an organization that I have great respect for, great admiration for. And, you know, it's not good. Now, long-term effects of the president, commander-in-chief, berating, belittling institutions like that. There's the premier law enforcement organization in the world. And that's not good. It can't be good for morale of those institutions.
It doesn't seem to have gone away. It seems to have changed, or maybe is not being employed at this point. But what we do see on a fairly regular basis is pot shots at people like Attorney General Sessions, who's a member of the intelligence community as well. And so it seems to continue, although it doesn't seem to be directed specifically at the core organizations like the CIA, FBI, at on a daily basis. But there's always something there that I'm wondering how that impacts you as somebody who spent 50-plus years in that world.
I think the Attorney General Sessions is in a little different position since he's a political appointee and presumably a transitory. The concern I've always had, of course, are for the professionals, the career officers who serve in the intelligence and law enforcement communities, and those are the people that I worry about more. People like the Attorney General, Director Wray, Director Coates, and now Director Haspel, I think they have probably a heavier burden in that they've got to provide the top cover in order to allow those career professionals to do their job. And the important thing for the intelligence community, I've always said, is for them to continue to serve up truth to power, whether the power listens to the truth or not.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of that, I've read Comrade Kruchkov's instructions. I'm sure you may remember that from years ago.
Actually, I don't, so you'll have to refresh my memory.
He was the head of the KGB for a number of years, and he, in fact, came to the U.S. with Mikhail Gorbachev in 1986. A book was written by a defector shortly thereafter, and this individual said in that book, and he wrote specifically, that President Trump had been essentially targeted by the KGB early on in his fairly young in his life, after he married his first wife. The individuals who were instrumental in essentially guiding, or shall we say, managing the Kremlin's interest in him, was a guy named Vitaly Churkin, another guy by the name of Vladimir Putin, who worked in Dresden at the time.
In the KGB.
Exactly. We're talking with former Director of National Intelligence Jim Clapper, who's written a book called Facts and Fears, a fascinating interview. And when we come back, something even more fascinating.
Enemies of Putin or opponents of his, journalists is another category of people that are caught up in this, who for various reasons and in various ways are neutralized.
Also, when we return, we ask Clapper if Russian intelligence has compromised President Trump, when we continue on Target USA,
the National Security Podcast.
This is a big year. The Ohio Lottery's golden anniversary. 50 years of excitement, of growing jackpots and crossed fingers. 50 years of funding for schools, of changed lives and brightened days. 50 years of fun. And that is worth celebrating. So watch for can't-miss promotions, huge events, and new games that will make the Ohio Lottery's 50th year its biggest one yet. Learn more at funturns50.com.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's Mix and Match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
I'm JJ Green, and this is Target USA,
the National Security Podcast.
On this edition, we've been talking with former Director of National Intelligence James Clapper. He's got a new book out. It's called Facts and Fears. We've spent a lot of time talking about Russia. One of the key elements that we just got into before the break was the relationship between President Trump, Vitaly Churkin, and Vladimir Putin. And we pick up our conversation here. There are many other accounts and facts and people and information that has been swirling around those three names for a while. What I found interesting, and I want to ask your thought on this, is that Churkin died suddenly. Mikhail Lessin died suddenly. Several other people connected to Mr. Putin have died suddenly. Others who aren't necessarily that close to him have died suddenly. What do you make of all of these scenarios where these folks that go way back deep into history that may have some relationship to him or Mr. Trump dying?
Well, you know, there's a history here of Putin apparently, because we in all cases we don't have direct empirical evidence of this, but we're enemies of Putin or opponents of his. Journalists is another category of people that are caught up in this, who for various reasons and in various ways are neutralized. And this is, historical old-time KGB practice. That's what Putin's all about. That's what motivates him. And so the way he thinks, I think, is heavily influenced by his KGB experience. So I don't know the specifics the theory that you've explained, but it certainly comports with classical Russian Soviet practice, and particularly something that Putin would at least be complicit in, if not if he didn't direct it. So, yeah, it's entirely consistent. I also say the Russians look for every opportunity they can to co-opt someone to gain influence, access, whatever. An American who has some prominence, and if they get the opportunity, they'll do it. And I think so that all of what you say is it, to me, is consistent.
So then I want to fall off the cliff here. I've been very good and very rigid along the lines of strict journalism, but one of the things that happens quite often in our world today is we get caught up in gossip. But I want to just give you a heads up that I want to ask something that's not necessarily vetted or proven or anything like that. Uh-huh. I do want to ask you, though, do you have any concerns about the president or anybody in his circle possibly being compromised by the Russians?
Well, yeah, I'm concerned about it, but I don't have any evidence that is, in fact, the case. I mean, that's, you know, lots of people ask, obviously the salacious material in the infamous dossier, and the Russians, like the Soviets before them, it's a standard practice of theirs to gather what they call compromat, their acronym for compromising material, whether it's real or contrived. So lots of people ask about, you know, what is the explanation for President Trump's, you know, almost aggressive indifference to Russia, and specifically his refusal to dime out Putin. And there's any number of potential explanations for that, but they're all speculative. Certainly that's one. Financial entanglements, just the fact that he admires autocrats, or as Mike Hayden once suggested, incompetence, or some combination of the above, I really don't know.
So I don't want to spend too much more time on this because you did more things than just this. I mean, there's also in your book this part about Osama bin Laden. There's the Benghazi attack. There's Edward Snowden. So I'd like to chat a little bit about those before our time is up. But, you know, in reading your book, chapter 11, you know, page 312, on December 4th, 2011, Russians went to the polls in what would be the most closely contested parliamentary election since Vladimir Putin and his United Russia Party came to power in 99, when Putin succeeded Boris Yeltsin in power and never left. Putin served two terms as Russia's second president, but was constitutionally prevented from running for a third time, so he stepped down in 2008, nominating Dmitry Medvedev to stand for United Russia. The question that I want to ask you after reading that, did you ever have in your mind that Vladimir Putin was ever leaving office voluntarily or when his term ended? Or did you always know that this was what was going to happen? He was going to try to essentially be a dictator.
Yeah, I thought the whole Medvedev arrangement was a contrivance, just to, where the real power would still be Putin, and that he'd find some way to contrive a way to come back. And I always suspected that, and, you know, had no basis for it, but that was my view. And, you know, that's what he's doing. And we're going to have him for at least six more years.
Then my last question on Russia then is, how does the U.S., what's the U.S. going to do then to kind of get back on its feet, if you will? Because by all intents, what Russia was intending to do, correct me if I'm wrong, was to sow seeds of chaos across this country and to create substantial doubt in the institutions of the U.S., one of which is the rule of law. And they seem to have succeeded on a grand scale. I'm not sure if you agree with that or not, but where does the U.S. go from here in terms of Russia?
Accurately captured their first objective, which was to do exactly as you said. So doubt, discord, discontent, disrupt to the extent that they could. And what they did was exploit all the polarization and schisms in this country. So they had messages for everybody. And unfortunately, the United States is a ripe target for them. Their second objective, though, then was to do all they could to hurt Hillary Clinton's candidacy. And that stemmed from personal animus that Putin had for both Clintons. And he actually held her responsible for fomenting what he thought was a color revolution in 2011. And then as time went on and they began to take Mr. Trump seriously, like everybody else did, after not having initially taken him seriously, they then thought that he would be a much better president for them than she would be. So those were kind of the three objectives. What do we do about it? Well, one is to do the obvious things to secure our voting apparatus. And I think in their exceptions, but I think there's been progress made there. But the hardest part of all this, JJ, is getting the public to understand what the Russians are doing, understand how massive the effort is that they've made, and that they will continue to do that. And they absolutely positively must be more questioning, more inquisitive about things that they read or hear. And so that's, kind of the inspiration of the book. I said, I got to do my little part, having an appreciation, having an understanding of what they did and do, to write a book that people could understand that. So what would really help, what's missing here, well, parts of the government are doing their thing, the FBI, Department of Homeland Security, et cetera. What's missing is a strong, assertive recognition by the President of the United States as Commander-in-Chief of what the Russians did and the threat it poses to us, and that we're not going to allow it to happen again. And what we need is a galvanizing statement from the President of the United States to unite the country. And it isn't just an intergovernmental thing. It is an inter-society thing. Mm-hmm. And we don't have that that sort of assertive leadership.
Mm-hmm. Well, you did a great job in this book in educating me. And if you can educate me, then I'm pretty sure you're doing okay with the rest of the public, because I don't by any chance and under any circumstance think that I'm the smartest guy in the room. But I do think that what you did in this book was very beneficial in everything that you discussed. A couple more things before our time is up.
Thanks, JJ, for that, though. But yeah, go ahead.
Sure. So some of the other things you write about in the book, Osama bin Laden, give me your thoughts on that.
Well, I try to convey, the moment. I mean, lots has been written about UBL and the takedown, so I don't know that I had factually much to add to that. The thing I wanted to impart in the book was the impact on me when I walked out of the West Wing and walked across the portico adjacent to the Rose Garden there to go sit with a few people and listen to the president's speech. And there was already, word had already gotten out. There was a big crowd in Lafayette Park, and they were chanting, USA, USA, USA.
How'd that make you feel?
I will never forget the impact on me. It was been closeted in the sit room for 13 hours and really hunkered down, concentrating very hard on what was a very tense evolution. And then to have that was, release. It was emotional. It was impactful. It represented closure for the country, closure for the intelligence community, and certainly closure for me as an individual in the intelligence community, like it was for so many of us.
So at that time, what sense did you get about the fight, the war against terror at that point? What did you think? Where did you think it was at that point? Because that was before ISIS emerged.
Yeah, at that point, because Osama bin Laden was so isolated and so cut off, it was very hard for him to be an operational, tactical leader. So he had become a symbol, but to be sure, an important one. But he was much more symbolic than he was substantive, I believe, at the time he was taken down. I've always felt that we are going to be in a state of suppression of terrorism for a long time to come. We've killed a lot of terrorists, and we'll kill some more, but until the fundamental conditions that give rise to the appeal of terrorism, until they're fixed, we're going to be doing this for a long time. So whether it's Al-Qaeda or ISIS or some other group that spawned, we're always going to have to be vigilant about the threat of terrorism.
Moving on to Edward Snowden, how much damage now that you're, what are we, 5 years out from that, how much damage has he done?
Well, if you're a taxpayer, you're going to be paying for what it takes to recover from the damage he caused to our foreign intelligence capabilities for some time to come. And the problem is, as Bill Evanina, who is the nominee to be confirmed as the National Counterintelligence and Security Center director, recently observed, there are a lot more documents that he purloined that have not surfaced. There are actually comparatively only a few, maybe 400 or 500 documents that have over time emerged that he purloined. So you ask how much damage, that's not determined yet. And that's why I think the intelligence community is on its maybe sixth or seventh damage assessment that they render when more documents surface publicly, and then they go assess the damage. And so this could go on for years.
Wow. Well, that's definitely not what I was hoping to hear, but it is fact is fact, and that's what you deal in. That's what you have to deal in. Are there any final thoughts that you'd like to share with us about anything that you wrote about in your book that I haven't asked you about? There are many things in there, and it's a fascinating read.
Well, I appreciate that, and I've gotten a lot of feedback like that, which is very gratifying. I think one of the underlying messages I wanted to try to convey was that intelligence is a noble profession. It's a sacred public trust. I think it's and I hope that young people, you know, high school, college age, might, if they read it, consider spending time in the national security community and specifically in the intelligence community. It's something I always found challenging and interesting, and I think that's you know, one of the reasons I stuck with it for so long. So that was certainly another theme I hope to impart by writing the book.
Well, Director Clapper, it's been a pleasure to talk to you, and an even greater pleasure to have known you for a considerable amount of time and to have followed your career and had a few chances to sit with you and to talk to you.
Thanks, JJ. I would very much appreciate engaging with you in the future.
That's it for this episode. Coming up on the next edition of Target USA.
Portugal doesn't look at Russia as an enemy. We look at Russia as an adversary.
EU, member states, tightening the screws on Russia.
We will never recognize, never, all the annexations, for instance, of Crimea, never.
And José Alberto de Azeredo López, National Defense Minister for Portugal, has some advice about how to think about Russia's presence on the global stage.
We believe that it's impossible to construct a discourse on global defense and security, thinking only on Russia. And if we do so, we are contributing to reinforce Russia because we are building an image of Russian power that is maybe disproportionate with reality.
The bottom line, while polite diplomacy still exists, gone is the tolerance of Russia's aggressive behavior. Coming up on our next episode, thank you for listening, and thank you for your support. Please subscribe to our podcast, and also let me know what you think. Send me an email at jgreen@wtop.com. That's the letter J, the color green, at Whiskey Tango Oscar Papa, jgreen@wtop.com. I'm JJ Green, and this is Target USA,
the National Security Podcast.
Hi, this is Ben Domenech, the host of the Federalist Radio Hour. We're a daily show coming to you 5 days a week from Washington, D.C., where we interview our nation's top journalists, politicians, authors, chefs, economists, entertainers, and more. If you're looking for a contrarian discussion on news, politics, or culture, give us a listen and subscribe at PodcastOne.com, the new Podcast One app, or at Apple Podcasts.
Now, stay tuned for the latest headlines from the Associated Press.